All right. Good evening, everyone. Let's begin. So I want to pick up this week in all of these parshios of Reishis. The truth is, it's exceptionally difficult to try to figure out what to focus on, being that there are so many dramatic stories, so many dramatic episodes which unfold over the course of any particular parsha. But what I find especially dramatic and traumatic throughout many of these parshios, really beginning last week and kind of coming to a head this week, is the incredible friction and difficulty between Yosef and his brothers. So remember, again, it's in last week's parsha that we learn about the formation, the creation of Yaakov Avinu's family, 4 wives, 12 sons, and a lot of drama, right? And then we saw the drama with Dinah, the daughter, as well. And in this week's parsha, everything really coils up after Yaakov Avinu goes ahead and gives Yosef an additional article of clothing, a coat, a kisonas pasim, a beautiful coat that was nicer than the coat of his brothers, and animosity begins to develop between the brothers, hatred begins to develop between the brothers, until we finally come to the point where the brothers are ready to actively kill Yosef. They're literally ready to kill him. Yosef ventures out to find what's happening with his brothers in Shechem. The brothers see him. They see an opportunity to rid the family of this ongoing Yosef problem. And only because Yehuda intervenes in the last moment and says, listen, why should we kill him? Let's just go ahead and throw him into a pit. And we could go ahead and figure out what to do with him afterwards, that Yosef is saved. Saved, of course, is a relative term. He's saved physically. You know, one of the important things when it comes to these stories in Bereishis is often when we look at them, so remember, we see them through the lens of knowing how everything works out. So we read this story, and the truth is, it's not so troubling to us, because at the end of the day, we know Yosef goes down to Mitzrayim, he becomes the viceroy, he becomes the second in command. Ultimately, again, everything works out beautifully. He marries a nice girl, he has kids, he sustains the entire civilized world, so everything is great. That's fine when you know the end of the story. But at the end of the day, we see the story unfold, and there's an incredible amount of tension, because if you're reading it for the first time, and you see young 17-year-old Yosef, literally stripped of his clothing and his dignity by his brothers, thrown into a pit, sold like a piece of property, it's incredibly distressing, overwhelmingly distressing. So it's the end of that story that I want to pick up on, meaning how the brothers did such a thing, what their rationale for doing such a thing, that's a discussion unto itself. I want to focus on what happens after the sale. Take a look at number one. Vayichu es kisonas Yosef, vayishchetu si'ir izim, vayitpulu es akasonas badam. So the brothers, of course, now have an incredible predicament, which is, what do we do about Yosef? Excuse me, or what do we do about Yaakov? Obviously, we can't tell Yaakov what happened. We can't tell Yaakov that we sold Yosef. So instead, they do something very interesting. They take the coat of Yosef, and they dip it in the blood of a ram. Why a ram? Because Rashi points out that ram's blood is very similar to human blood. Vayishalchu es kesonas hapasim vayaviu al aviem vayumru zos matzanu. And they send the cloak, or they send the cloak to Yaakov. And they say to Yaakov, do you recognize this? Do you recognize this coat? And then something amazing happens, which is, Yaakov sees the coat, he sees that it's torn, and he sees that it's covered in blood. So the conclusion that he reaches is, Yosef's been killed by a wild animal. Now, again, remember, I want to point out, the brothers never say a word. The only thing the brothers ever say to Yaakov is what? Do you recognize the cloak? That's the only thing they say. Do you recognize the cloak? And what else is a parent? What else, chas v'shalom, is a father supposed to think? Remember, no one knows where Yosef is. No one ultimately, again, no one's seen Yosef. So all we have is his cloak torn up into pieces, covered with blood that appears like human blood. Yaakov Avinu reaches the regular conclusion, or the normal conclusion, that Yosef must have been killed by a wild animal.
His brothers saying, is this your son's coat?
Right. So they ask Yaakov, do you recognize the coat? Yeah. Yaakov says yes, and he draws the conclusion. No, don't be sorry, Chas v'shalom. And he draws the conclusion ultimately saying, yes, it's the son, it's the coat of my son. He must have been torn apart by a wild animal. Okay? Vayis'abel al bino yamim rabim. And he mourns for his son for many days. But here's the part that I want to focus on. The last verse in number one. Vayakumu kol banav v'chol b'nosav l'nachamo. All of his sons and daughters. This actually refers to daughters-in-law. So all of his sons and daughters-in-law got up to go ahead and console him. Vayima'en l'hisnachim. He refused to be consoled. Vayomer, because he said, Ki ered el bini eval sha'ola, I will go down to the grave mourning for my son, Vayevch oso aviv. And Yaakov continuously goes ahead and mourns for Yosef. And by the way, just so you understand, how long does Yaakov Avinu's mourning period last for? 22 years. 22-year shiva. That's what Yaakov Avinu sat for his son. It only ends when he finds out later on that Yosef, in fact, is still alive. Now, this dynamic of Yaakov Avinu's continuous mourning. Yaakov, and it's dramatic on so many levels. Vayima'en lehisnachim. What does it mean, vayima'en lehisnachim? He refused to be consoled. Refused to be consoled, which means he refused the efforts of others, as the Pasuk says, and he refused to allow himself to feel any level of consolation. He refused to allow the process of consolation to begin within himself. Now, this is troubling and problematic on a variety of different levels. If you take a look at number two, the Gemara Maseches Moed Katan says something amazing. The Gemara writes, Al tifku lemeis v'al tenadu bo. So he's quoting over here a pasuk from Jeremiah, from Yirmiyo, in number three. You see the whole verse there is in number three. So it literally means, weep not for the dead, neither bemoan him. What does that mean? How can you say, don't weep for the dead? What does he mean? We shouldn't mourn for our loved ones who leave this world? No. Rather, back to number two, for middle of the first line. Al tifku lemeis, yoser midai. Do not cry for the dead too much. What is the Gemara saying? Do not mourn excessively. Do not mourn excessively. Ve'al tinadu lo, and do not bemoan him, yoser mikashir. More than the amount, the shear that the rabbis have set up. What's the amount of time for mourning? Hakeitzad. Shlosha yamim lebechi. For the first 3 days after loss, that time is set aside for crying. Vishivala hesped. 7 more days set aside for eulogizing. Shloshim legiut letisporas. Another 30 days ultimately again when a person must refrain from other life activities. Mikan ve'elech. By the way, you don't have to read this Gemara. This Gemara is not meant literally because you could cry for longer. The idea is that when it says 3 days, just you should know, there's a halacha that's not as well known because it's not agreed upon by everyone, which is there is a custom not to visit a mourner during the first 3 days of Shiva. There's a concept not to do Nicham Avelim during the first 3 days. Why? Because the assumption is that the mourner is most consumed by grief for the first 3 days, and the best thing you could do for them is give them their space. After 3 days, the mourning, of course, continues, but perhaps they may be a bit more receptive to your overtures, they may be a bit more receptive or appreciative or open to your visit. So there's the 3 days of intense mourning, there's the 7 days of continued reflection, and there's shloshim. Of course, you know, in halachic avelos, in mourning in Jewish law, there are other structures. There's different laws of mourning for a parent, different laws of mourning for a child, for a spouse. We're not going to get into those details. The point that the Gemara is making is what? Is that there is a framework for mourning. And the framework for mourning teaches us a very important lesson, which is mourning in Jewish law has a beginning and has an end. Mourning cannot go on indefinitely. The Gemara says, Mikan ve'elech, if you mourn your loved one too long after these prescribed times, Amra Kodesh Baruch Hu, I atem rachmanim bo yoser mimeni. This is actually amazing. God says, don't act like you are more compassionate than I am. Meaning HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I run the world. I have a plan. I know what happened hurt you, but there has to come a certain point in time where you're able to move forward with this new reality. You cannot go on mourning indefinitely. Now I want to point out something very interesting. When we talk about you can't go on mourning indefinitely, what are we referring to over here? What type of mourning? Right, external displays. Remember again, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not telling me what I should feel in my heart. A person loses a loved one, a person loses a very piece of themselves. There's a part of me that goes to the grave with my loved one. There's a part of me that can never be retrieved. There's a part of me that's never again made whole. That doesn't change after 3 days, after 30 days, sometimes not even after 30 years. That's not what the Gemara is talking about. The Gemara is talking about how we carry ourselves externally. That at some point in time, a person has to get it back together. And therefore, again, there's a cutoff. There's a point in time. And by the way, we even see this during mourning. For example, there's a fascinating halacha. What happens on Shabbos when a person is in the midst of mourning? Right? So amazing enough, you know, again, it's a dramatic scene for a person sitting Shiva. Lo Alini, we shouldn't know from it. But, right, a person is sitting mourning. I'm sitting with my torn clothing. I'm sitting on a low chair. Everything's covered. Comes Shabbos. What happens? Right? Everything looks normal, right? Everything is supposed to be restored to what it was. And even in a more dramatic fashion, if Yom Tov, right, one of the Jewish holidays, happens to intervene, happens to come in the middle of mourning, what's the halacha? Mourning is stopped. Mourning is stopped. That has to do with the fact that there's a biblical obligation to rejoice. The biblical obligation to rejoice trumps my personal need to go ahead and mourn. But the point is that in Jewish law, there's a beginning to mourning and there's an end to mourning. And I am not permitted to carry on external displays of mourning. A person says, you know what? I'm in such deep mourning, I want to wear my torn clothing for 30 days. You're not allowed to do that. That's not the halacha. I wear torn clothing during the Shiva, and that's it. There's a beginning, there's an end. Which, of course, now brings us to a fundamental question, which is, how are we to understand Yaakov Avinu's behavior? How are we to understand Yaakov Avinu's ongoing mourning? Remember, again, Yaakov says two things. No, actually, he does two things. Number one, he does, he actively refuses to be consoled. He will not be consoled. He refuses consolation. And number two, he makes a dramatic statement. Ki eret el bini eva sha'ola. I will go down to my son to the grave. Which is a way of saying, I'm going to mourn forever. I'm going to mourn forever. I am hereby mourning from this day forward. How do you reconcile Yaakov Avinu's unending mourning with the norm expressed to us in the Gemara that mourning has to have a finite framework? That's question number one. Question number two is, what's the lesson for us? Because remember, again, and this is why sometimes you have to look at these stories with a critical eye, as if you're seeing it for the first time. We all like stories. Who doesn't like stories? But at the end of the day, Torah is not a storybook. The Torah is a book of laws. And the stories that are brought down are only brought down for their moral, ethical, or legal implications. Which means that wherever you see a story, you have to ask a very simple question, which is, why is this here? Why is this here? Why is this brought down? What is the lesson for me? So two fundamental questions. One question on Yaakov Avinu, how do we understand the behavior, the unending mourning of the patriarch Jacob? And question number two, what's the lesson for us? So I'll share with you a couple of different approaches this evening. Take a look at number four. So Rashi comments on this and he says as follows. He refuses to be consoled. So this is amazing. Rashi quotes the Gemara. Ein adam yachol lekabel tanchumin alachai v'savar shemes. Because a person can never find consolation for someone who they think is dead, but is really alive. So Rashi says, the fundamental problem here is that Yaakov Avinu cannot be consoled for the death of his son. Why? Why? Because Baruch Hashem, his son is alive. Now Rashi over here is quoting an amazing Gemara. She'al hames nigzira gezira she'ishtachach min alev v'lo alachai. For there is a divine decree that we forget the dead, but we never forget the living. Look at number five. So this is a Gemara. The Gemara says, Tan Rabbanan, Shlosha Dvarim Alu B'machshava Libaros, V'im Lo Alu Dinhu She'yalu. There are three concepts that God kind of programmed into the fabric of the world. What are they? These are actually quite amazing. Al Hames She'yasriach. Number one, that a body decomposes. A body decomposes. God made sure that a body should decompose. Why is that like such a great thing that a body should decompose? So Rashi points out over here, because ultimately, again, if the body would not decompose, people would hold on to the bodies of their loved ones for longer periods of time. So again, first of all, we see this, by the way, one of the most dramatic ways in which Jewish mourning practices are dramatically different than practices that you'll find in greater society or even in other religions, is we don't preserve bodies. So because we don't preserve bodies, we make sure to bury bodies as quickly as possible. We don't do viewings for this exact reason. So this idea, Kadosh Baruch Hu purposely said the body decomposes, and the body decomposition begins relatively quickly, I'm not going to get too into this over here, but relatively quickly after the death of a person. This was a chesed. This was a kindness that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did for us, because if this wouldn't happen, people would linger around the corpse of their loved one for too long. People would go ahead, I mean, Rashi even says that literally, again, hayu matznien also, they would hold on to the body. Again, why would they hold on to the body? Out of a desire to maintain some level of physical connection with their loved one. That's number one. Number two, Va'al hames shenishtachach min alev. God decreed that the dead are ultimately forgotten. The dead are forgotten. Now, what does this mean, that the dead are forgotten? Of course, this is not literal. Anyone who's ever lost a loved one knows you never forget your loved ones. What it means is, over time, loss is pushed to the recesses of the mind. And depending, again, what the nature of the loss is, sometimes it could even be pushed from the consciousness to the subconscious. See, when a person loses a loved one, that loss becomes the entirety of their process of cognition. That loss becomes the entirety. I see nothing but my loss. I see nothing but my loss. And then something amazing happens, which is, the loss is still there, but as time goes on, it's no longer the first thing I think about. It's not the first thing I think about when I wake up in the morning. It's not the last thing I think about when I go to sleep at night. I may think about it many times throughout the day, and it still may occupy, you know, real estate in my consciousness, but it's not the only thing I think about. HaKadosh Baruch Hu programmed us this way, with this ability, and I put in quotations, to forget. Forgetfulness in this context doesn't literally mean to forget, but rather it means to push from the front of my mind, ultimately again to some recess of the mind. And lastly, V'ala tvua shetirakev. And God also decreed that wheat should rot. Wheat should rot. So Rashi points out over here that this was an issue concerning business. If wheat would not rot, people would accumulate wealth and potentially cause food shortages in the world. So I often thought that the meaning behind this is actually a little bit different. Wheat represents materialism. So the fact that wheat rots indicates to us what? You can't hold on to anything material in this world. As a wise man once taught me, the hearse doesn't have a luggage rack, right? You can't go ahead and take anything with you in this world. You can't even hold on to it really in this world. You certainly can't hold on to it once you leave this world. The wheat rots. Materialism is fleeting. You could have it, you could enjoy it, you could earn it, you could own it, but you cannot guarantee that you could go ahead and hold on to it. So Rashi says something amazing. There's a gzeira, there's a divine decree. The way the world is programmed is that ultimately, again, the dead are forgotten. The problem, says Rashi, is that it's not that Yaakov Avinu is being resistant to consolation. Yaakov can't find consolation, because consolation is a function of this divinely programmed forgetfulness. But that process is only triggered if what? If the person's dead. Yosef is not dead. Therefore, the innate process of forgetting the dead, and I keep using, I'm not going to keep explaining it except for one last time. When I say forgetting, you're going to say, I don't really mean forgetting. I mean forgetting in quotation marks, pushing from the, we'll call it from the front of the mind to the recesses of the mind. That can't happen for Yaakov Avinu, ultimately because his son is alive. So ask the Maharal in number 7. So the Maharal says, look in the Gur Aryeh, he says, V'in tomar, the Yaakov hayolo lachshov, the Maharal asks a very simple question. He says, okay, me'achar shayolo yachol lekabel tanchumin, bevadai chayhu. So why doesn't Yaakov knew this concept also, that God pre-programmed us to forget the dead? So why doesn't Yaakov think to himself, you know what, this doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. I'm not feeling any better day after day, right? I'm not feeling better a week later, 2 weeks later, 5 years later. I still feel terrible. So why doesn't Yaakov Avinu begin to think to himself what? Maybe Yosef is alive. Right? Meaning, why doesn't he put the pieces together and begin to say to himself, if I can't forget, it must mean that Yosef is still alive. V'yesh lomar, al hamis nigzira gizira sheishtacha chemenu, aval in zman kavua umugbal lazeh. So the Maharal says something absolutely profoundly amazing. It is true that the dead are forgotten. People find the ability to move on. But what Chazal don't tell us is what? How long it takes. The rabbis just tell us that God pre-programmed us with this incredible coping mechanism. That I don't have to do anything. It's almost triggered by itself. I just have to allow it to happen. Where the loss, which once all I saw was loss, over time the loss is pushed to the recesses of my mind, to the recesses of my soul. It's still there, but I don't think about it all of the time. Says the Maharal, that's true. But Chazal don't tell us how long it takes. And the reason Chazal don't tell us how long it takes, of course, is why? Because it takes differing amounts of time by different people. Different losses come with different amounts of intensity. Different people have different emotional makeups. And therefore, again, as far as Yaakov Avinu is concerned, it's just going to take him more time. Remember, again, the loss of Yosef was traumatic for Yaakov on a variety of different... I'll take questions later. On a variety of different levels. Which was that, remember, Yosef was Yaakov's bechor. Right? Yosef was really Yaakov's firstborn. Why? Because Yosef was the son of Yaakov's desired wife, of Yaakov's Rachel. So remember again, this is complex on so many different levels. So now Rachel dies in childbirth with Binyamin. You know, all the Mefarshim ask why it is that Yaakov had a special relationship with Yosef, but yet he doesn't seem to have that same special relationship with Binyamin. Isn't that interesting? Although you would have thought, again, younger children, ask any younger child about the perks of being the youngest child in the family, right? It's literally, you've got like a blank check. Your parents are exhausted already, right? They've tried every strategy and it usually didn't work anyway. So they figure, you know what, just let this one raise itself. He or she is going to be fine. We can't mess them up any more than the others. So you know what? So Binyamin yet is not the prized child. It's Yosef. Why? Because understand, when Yaakov looked at Binyamin, he understood that the birth of this child cost him his beloved wife. There was incredible pain. Remember, Binyamin's name means Ben Oni, the son of my affliction. The very name of Binyamin captures the death of Rachel Imenu, which was exceptionally traumatic for Yaakov on so many different levels. So Yosef is what he has. So this idea that he loses Yosef, which essentially was, you have to understand something, the birth of Yosef, you know, Every child that comes into this world, you know, when a person is blessed with children, so it's always interesting to see that when children enter into a parent's life at different stages, so a parent has a different type of relationship with that child depending on what stage of life that child came into my life. So for Yaakov Avinu, when Yosef comes into this world, it's like everything is great. I've got my Rachel. I've amassed my wealth. Okay, I still have problems with my father-in-law, but for many of us, that goes on for many years, right? So I still have problems with my father-in-law, but at the end of the day, again, life is good. Life is good. And so for Yaakov, you know, Yosef represented the way life was supposed to be, and now it's gone. And so I'm inconsolable. I understand that ultimately, again, there's a process that ultimately is triggered, that the dead are forgotten, but maybe I'm just not there yet. But then the Maharal says something amazing. If you turn the page, in paragraph Gimel, he says something amazing. V'yesh mefarshim, others explain, ki Yaakov chashav, ki lekach eno misnachim, mipnei shelo haya misyaish mikvuraso. Says the Maharal, there's something else at play over here. There is a major piece missing from the mourning process, which is the funeral. And more specifically, the burial. You see, Yaakov Avinu, all he gets back is a torn coat that is covered in blood. There was never an opportunity to go ahead and bury his son. Do you know that burial in Judaism is exceptionally important? Because what does it provide us with? Closure. Closure. You know, it's an amazing thing. Again, one of the dramatic differences between burial customs in Judaism versus other religions. You know, if you ever see, you know, sometimes the way other funerals are structured, it's beautiful, right? There's flowers, there's wreaths, there's often, like, you can't see the dirt. The casket is kept above the hole in the ground. Sometimes the hole is even covered. There are no shovels, nothing. You come to a Jewish levaya, you come to a Jewish funeral, what do you see? There's a pine box, a hole in the ground, five shovels, and a mound of earth, right? There's no flowers. Because Judaism believes that in order for people to move on, they must have closure in this point. You have to bury your dead. You have to bury your dead. And we can't go ahead and pretend like it's okay. We can't go ahead and beautify it. We can't pretty it up. It is what it is. It's painful, it's raw, it's tragic, it's difficult. But what it allows you to do is to move forward. What it allows you to do ultimately is to accept the reality as it is and ultimately again move forward. Yaakov Avinu was never able to bury his son. So because he was never able to bury his son, he thought to himself, maybe that's why I can't find any type of consolation. I never had the opportunity to at least say goodbye in a formal fashion. I never had the opportunity to give a proper hesped, to give a proper eulogy. I never had the opportunity, just with my own hands, to put the earth in my son's grave, as tragic and as horrendous as that is. At least, again, it's the last chesed, the last act of kindness that a parent can do for a child. And Yaakov Avinu says, I never even had the opportunity to do that. So maybe that's why I can't go ahead and find any consolation. I never even had the opportunity to attend the Levaya. If you look at the Svarno in number 8, Svarno has a different approach. He says, this is actually amazing. He says, if you look at the second line, Vayomer ki ered el b'ni evech evel sho'ola, I will go down to my son mourning to the grave, meaning, again, I will not be consoled. Kibel alov avelus l'chol yamav. The Svarno says, Yaakov Avinu took upon himself mourning until his last day. Meaning he said, I'm going to remain in a state of mourning until I die. Why? Mipnei she'ira hatakala al yado, sheshalach es Yosef el Echov. Why? Says something very powerful. Guilt. You see, remember, how did Yosef wind up in this predicament? Now again, Yaakov Avinu, of course, doesn't know the story. In fact, it's a dramatic discussion amongst the commentaries as to whether or not Yaakov Avinu ultimately ever finds out the story. You see, if you'll notice, what's missing in the Chumash, I don't want to spoil the story for you, but Yosef is okay, Baruch Hashem. He's going to become the viceroy in Egypt. 22 years from now, it's going to be a reunification. And one would have thought that the first word that Yaakov would say to Yosef was what?
Where you been?
Right? Well, I know where you've been. You've been in Egypt. More importantly, what happened? What happened? The last thing I had of you was your torn and bloodied coat. How did you get here? You know, the Torah never records that conversation. The Torah never records that conversation. We'll discuss that in future weeks, why that is. What Yaakov knew, what Yaakov didn't know. One thing he did know, which is Yosef disappears from the family in Shechem. How did Yosef get to the city of Shechem? How did he get there? Yaakov instructs him to go and check on his brothers. So therefore, says the Svarno, Yaakov is riddled with guilt. I did this to my son. Had I not sent him to check on his brothers, he would still be here with me. Now again, remember, this is not assuming that Yaakov suspects that the brothers did anything. Whatever happened to Yosef, it happened to Yosef because he was out of the house. Had I not sent him, this would have never happened. Why does Yaakov refuse consolation? You see, because sometimes the reason people refuse to be consoled is because they don't believe that they deserve to be consoled. I deserve to suffer. I deserve to hurt. I deserve to live a life of pain. Why? Because I did this. Because I, Yaakov, did this. Now, of course, Yaakov didn't do this. Right, Yaakov had nothing to do with this. I mean, he had something to do with it in that he kind of stoked the fire a little bit between the brothers because he gave something extra to Yosef that he didn't give to the other brothers. But Yaakov didn't do this. But this is the power of guilt. The power of guilt says to Yaakov, you don't deserve consolation. You don't deserve to feel better. Look what you did to your family. Look what you did to your son. Look what you did to the legacy of your now deceased wife. You don't deserve to be happy again. So because of that guilt, Yaakov Avinu refuses consolation. The Kli Yakara number 9 takes a more esoteric approach. And this is actually quite amazing. The The Kliyak writes, "V'tamo shel davar hu shikra tanchumin hu kishayiten achay al libo shezeh hameis zochel rav tuv atzafel and tzadikim." So this is actually very interesting. The Kliyak posits, after a person endures loss, where does consolation come from? You see, there's a sefer on the laws of Avilos called the Geshra Chaim, written by Rav Tukachinsky. And Rav Tukachinsky, Zechut Tzadik Livracha, asks a very simple question. Why do we mourn? Why do we mourn when people die? Right? If we believe in an afterlife, if we believe in Olam Haba, then why are we mourning? And he says very simply, we're not mourning for the dead, we're mourning for ourselves. Right? Because I believe that my loved one is in a much better place. And I would have loved to have them more time. I'm mourning for me because there's a void in my life. There's a gaping hole in my life. I'm never going to be the same. So I'm sitting here reflecting on the life of my loved one, but I'm not crying for them. I'm crying for me. Mourning is a very reflexive process. It is about me. It's not really about my loved one. Because we believe, that ultimately, again, when a person dies, they go to a place, although we don't know where it is, we don't know where it is, we don't know what it is, but we believe that it's something magnificent, beautiful, and spiritual. So something amazing happens. He says, V'Yaakov, look at the third line, middle of the line. V'Yaakov ro'a b'ruach ha'kodesh, she'yosef eino b'gan Eden. So this is a bit more esoteric, writes the Arachai, writes the Kliyakar. Yaakov Avinu in his prophecy, in his prophetic prowess, searches the Garden of Eden to look for Yosef. Because what does every parent want to know? I want to know that my child is okay. So my child, Yosef's child, is no longer in this world. He wants to make sure that he's okay in Gan Eden. So he looks through Gan Eden, and there's only one problem, which is he doesn't see Yosef. Now, of course, we know why he doesn't see Yosef. Because Yosef is alive. I was going to say alive and well. Maybe not well, but he's alive. But when Yaakov Avinu does not see Yosef, what in Gan Eden, what does he assume? You know, there's only one of two destinations after 120. And if you're not in Gan Eden, you're in the other place, right? You're somewhere, we spoke about this morning in the Perek Shirashir. You're in Gehenna. You're somewhere that's not Gan Eden. And this gives Yaakov incredible anxiety. How could it be that my child is not in Gan Eden? So there's the trauma of losing my child, there's the trauma of the loss, and now the trauma is compounded because what does that mean as my failure as a parent? Or what does it mean about the failure of my son, that even now that he's no longer in this world, ultimately, again, he's not even in Gan Eden. But if we bring all of these different approaches together, and again, each of these are an approach onto themselves, and understanding the complexity of Yaakov Avinu's mourning, understanding the complexity of tragic loss, understanding the complexity of guilt, understanding the complexity when a person doesn't feel that they deserve to be happy. But it really all comes down to, I think, one profound basic idea. If you take a look at number 10, this is from an incredible book, and I think it's required reading. You know, everyone knows the book, The Jewish Way in Death and Mourning, right? It's Rabbi Maurice Lam. It's like become like a staple of Shiva homes. The truth is, it's really a staple of life. But what many people don't know is Rabbi Lam actually wrote a second volume, and the volume is called Consolation. You can imagine what it's about, right? It's the sister volume to the Jewish law, the Jewish Way in Death and Mourning. The Jewish Way in Death and Mourning is all about mourning, loss, Shiva, Shloshim, the 11 months, everything like that. And Consolation is the period that occurs. Consolation is the book that's written for what happens after the mourning period is over. What's the process of healing? And he says something dramatically amazing. Right? It's a little bit long, but I want to do it inside. Paragraph A, number 10, paragraph A. In bereavement, people experience different levels of acceptance at different points in the process. Acceptance does not imply that we like what has happened, nor does it mean that we forget our loved one. It means that we appreciate the magnitude of what has happened, that we know that our lives will never be the same, that we must learn to live with our loss and to accept the reality of the person who has been lost, both the good and the not so good. So that's, by the way, a different discussion, not for now. That's sometimes one of the most traumatic parts of loss is, you know, the whole point of Shiva and the whole point of Shloshim is reflection on the life of a loved one. Well, you know, most of us have things about us that are good and have things about us that are not so good. And sometimes, again, when you lose a loved one, not only do you have the beautiful memories, but sometimes you have some of the really not so beautiful memories as well. And those have to be dealt with in the context of mourning. But that's not our point. Take a look at paragraph B. To accept means to realize fully that this tragedy has happened to us, unreal as it may seem, that God has decreed it, and that it is utterly irreversible. That no matter, that no amount of imagination or hope can ever bring the dead back to life. That life has changed forever. That rebelling against that change will be of no avail. And that we must allow the pain of absence to flow through us. Turn the page. Paragraph C. Accepting means that we are willing to relearn reality. This is an incredibly profound statement. Acceptance means that we are willing to relearn reality. It means that we understand that at some point we must end our impossible wish that the person we loved will return. It means being ready to clear psychic space in which to continue to love the deceased on a spiritual level. Now you're going to see, by the way, that all of these concepts that Rabbi Lam is talking about when dealing with loss are not just applicable with loss, meaning with death loss, but we're going to have they're applicable to other areas of life as well. Paragraph D. As a philosophy for mourners and others learning to live with pain and frustration, the idea of acceptance can be a powerful healing tool. Affirming death in its full terror can be a surprising source of serenity and an antidote to months, perhaps years, of denying, ignoring, and struggling. And where does Rabbi Lam get this from? Paragraph E. The Bible provides us an early example of this dynamic. Jacob, although he rends his clothes to indicate the tear in his heart after the death of Joseph, refuses to fully accept that Joseph has died. He takes the news that his sons bring him as news of a loss, not of an irretrievable death. Since he cannot bring himself to accept Joseph's death, he does not heal. So this is a profound idea. Says Rabbi Lam, do you want to know why Yaakov cannot find any level of consolation? Because he refuses to accept this new reality. I accept that my son is dead. I accept the fact that he's gone, but I cannot accept that this is the new reality of my life. I cannot accept it. Instead, what Yaakov loses himself is the reality that he had, which is no longer. This is not the reality. I don't want this reality. This is not the life I want. This is not the circumstances I want. I want the life I had a day ago. I want that life. But Yaakov, you can't have that life. But I want that life. And Yaakov, in his refusal to let go of his life that was a day ago and accept the life that he has now, cannot be consoled. Now, of course, as Rabbi Lam points out, in the biblical narrative, this is all to the good because Joseph is in fact not dead, but alive in Egypt, as Jacob finds out later. But Jacob's lifelong unresolved grieving does demonstrate that there can be no healing without stout-hearted acceptance. So says Rabbi Lam, that the message that the Torah is trying to convey to us is that ultimately, again, if you want to heal, you have to accept your new reality. If you want to heal, you cannot spend all of your emotional energy yearning and pining for what was, what could have been, what should have been. Rather, you have to find the power to accept the reality as it is. Paragraph F. Accepting the unchangeable does not require resignation or a refusal to use our talents and abilities to live life to its fullest. Rather, it can liberate us from crippling and counterproductive emotions, such as anxiety, fear, guilt, and remorse. And here is the best part. I meant to underline this. You can underline it because you keep the sheets. This is the test. Here we go. We need to ask ourselves, is there anything I can do about this problem today? If there is, I will do it. If there isn't, I will accept the predicament and not dissipate my soul and my stamina in senseless struggle. Out of such acceptance comes true serenity. Do I have the ability to change the circumstances? Then I absolutely should. If I don't have the ability to change the circumstances, then what? Then what? Then I accept them for what they are. Pause here for just a moment. And if this sounds familiar, if you look at source number 11, the Serenity Prayer. Right, the Serenity Prayer, it's actually an interesting historical debate as to who actually authored it. Usually it's attributed to Reinhold Niebuhr, who lived 1892 to 1971. He was an American theologian. The Serenity Prayer is most common or most popular now. Why? because it is part of every single 12-step program. And every single 12-step, well, I should say every single, many 12-step meetings begin with the recitation of the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Where does the serenity prayer come from? The truth is, it didn't come from Reinhold Niebuhr. It came from Parshas Vayeshev, right? Not the exact words, but the theme. What the Torah is trying to convey to us is Yaakov Avinu cannot be consoled. Why? Because he will not accept his reality for what it is. He's yearning and pining for what was. He's yearning and pining for what should be. Now again, remember, we're not faulting Yaakov Avinu for that. It's for good reason, because there was something inside his soul that would not let him accept this new reality, because his son was not dead. The reality of accepting his son as being dead would have been an incorrect reality as well. Go back to paragraph G. Robert Frost said it eloquently in 7 words. The best way out is always through. The best way out is always through. Acceptance means bowing to the inevitable, accepting life as is and not as if. We slowly come to recognize that the only aspects of life that we can control at will are not life or death, our own or others, but rather our attitudes and perspectives on what befalls us or bereaves us, and how we choose to react to them. We simply cannot blow the shadows away. We cannot renegotiate the past, only commemorate it and put it into service as a prelude, as the prelude it was meant to be. Paragraph H. Getting through is the only way to get to the highest level of grief resolution, which is transcending grief. But that cannot happen unless our grief has been processed rather than skipped over. Paragraph I. To accept is not to succumb. It is to survive with the past intact. It is not what we have lost, but what we have left that fashions a future. Such a profound statement. It is not what we have lost, but what we have left that fashions a future. The great Harvard philosopher William James summarized the truth of all misfortune. Being willing to have it so, acceptance of what has happened is the first step in overcoming the consequences of any misfortune. Don't fight. If you can't beat it, accept it. So ultimately, again, we begin to see that Yaakov Avinu is... Now, why is this important? So, of course, what the Torah is telling us is the story of Yaakov Avinu. Why? Because the story of Yaakov Avinu is the story that we all encounter. Hopefully not in as traumatic or dramatic or tragic of a way, but we all experience loss in life. So some of us experience actual tragic death loss. We experience the loss of a loved one. But the truth is, all of us experience loss. We all lose dreams, right? I guarantee, I don't have to take a poll, there's not one person here who didn't have dreams when we were younger. I mean, you're all very young, don't get me wrong. Seek myself. When I was younger, right? We all had dreams when we were younger. And the truth is, a lot of those dreams have not, and in reality, at this point in time, will not materialize. And there's a loss in there. There's a loss of self. There's a loss of hope. There's a loss of optimism. We lose out on opportunities. When we reflect back on our life and we remember that opportunity, that opportunity, that opportunity. I didn't take it because I thought it wasn't right, but maybe it was. Or I didn't take it because I was too busy, but I really wasn't too busy, I was just lazy. And we lose opportunities, we lose dreams, we lose so many different things over the course of the journey in life. And when you suffer loss, you have to make a choice. There are two ways to deal with loss. There are some people who are forever wrapped up in the dynamic of their loss. They live a life filled with mourning. Ki ered el b'ni evel sha'ola. They consign themselves to a life of loss. I'm so upset as to what has happened to me. I'm so upset that life has not gone according to plan. I'm so upset that things have not panned out the way I really feel they should have. And I'm going to spend all of my energy lamenting that, yearning and pining for what should have been. And where does that get you?
Nowhere.
Absolutely nowhere. That's what Yaakov Avinu did. Now again, I want to be clear. We're not faulting Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov Avinu is in an emotional catch 22. There's no way for him to really move forward, because at the end of the day, the reality is just not clear. There's something in him which holds him back, and that something is recognized only 22 years later when he realizes that his beloved Yosef ultimately is still alive. But ultimately, again, what we learn from Yaakov Avinu is that the only way forward is to accept the loss. In life, we all deal with loss on different levels. And the only way to manage loss in life is to say, okay, many things have been lost. Dreams have been lost. Opportunities have been lost. Loved ones have been lost. But here I am right now. So I have a choice to make. I can go ahead, draw the blinds, sit in darkness, and live a lifetime of Shiva, of mourning, over the opportunities, dreams, aspirations, and loved ones that have gone away, or I can choose to maximize the life that I have. Now the catch is, the life that I have may never be as beautiful as the life that I had. The life that I have now may never be as luminescent as the one I once had, or as the one I dreamt I would have. But you know, as the famous saying goes, you know, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with. I think it's a Ma'amar Chazal, right? But, you know, it applies to life. It applies to life. Sometimes you don't get to choose your circumstances. You don't get to choose your circumstances. So you have a choice. You could lament them, bemoan them, and wish they were different. And spend what Rabbi Lam calls all of your psychic energy trying to renegotiate the past, which is immutably unchangeable. Or you can say, here is where I stand. This is what I got. This is the hand that God has dealt me, that life has dealt me. This is the reality. Do I wish it could have been different? Sure. But at the end of the day, nothing I can do, no matter how much I wish, could ever change these circumstances. I accept my life for what it is. I accept my reality for what it is. Now that I accept my life for what it is, I can maximize my life for what it is. That's the message of Yaakov Avinu. That's the message that the Torah is trying to convey to us in Parshas Vayeshev. Interestingly enough, it's trying to teach it to us, not through what Yaakov did, but through what Yaakov didn't do. Sometimes we learn from the matriarchs and patriarchs what to do by mimicking their behavior. Sometimes we learn from them by doing the opposite of what they did. Yaakov Avinu remained in place. Yaakov Avinu could not accept. And by the way, when you live 22 years of mourning, you know what that does? You know what that does to you? Hopefully we'll never find out. But we know later on that when Yaakov meets Paro, you know the first thing that Paro says to Yaakov? What was the first question? How old are you? But by the way, it wasn't a, how old are you? It was a, how old are you? It was that question of, you look ancient. Yaakov Avinu wasn't so old. But you know what? When you live your life constantly brooding over the past that has slipped between your fingertips, when you lead your life mourning for that which is gone and can never be retrieved, it ages you. It saps the vitality from you. It sucks the very life force out of you. It changed Yaakov in an irreversible way. The Torah teaching us a most incredible lesson. The most powerful attribute we could have in life is the attribute of acceptance. We all experience loss. And we've all lost many meaningful things over the course of the journey of life. And I have news for you. We're going to lose more things over the course of the journey of life. Because loss is part of the fabric of the human condition. But how we deal with that loss in life ultimately determines our effectiveness and our success along this journey. We learn from Yaakov Avinu to master the art of acceptance. Accept your reality for what it is. Do not pine over what could have been, what should have been, or what was. And find the courage to maximize your circumstances as they are. Stop over here.